When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack, where we have spent all day sort of floundering about in ancient history recording today and medieval history, but we're back on more comfortable ground now, aren't we, Alina?
Oh, thank God I'm back on something that I know what the hell I might be talking about. So we have with us Jack Boucher, who's a history teacher and secondary head of history. And over the summer, he completed his MA in history. Yay! His dissertation was on tanks in Burma. And he's got a book coming out this summer. And for everyone, he will be at We Have Ways. So make sure you get your tickets to come and see him on the stage. Hi, Jack.
Hey, guys. Right. Nice to see you. Thank you for having me on as well.
You said the magic word when you pitched an episode to us, and that was tank. And we all know there are just tank wankers everywhere. But specifically, we're going to be talking about tanks in Burma today, aren't we?
Yeah, of course. Not least because it's sort of like the sort of the least appreciated part, I would say, of it. But yeah, it's actually one of the most important, I think.
So at the opening of hostilities, what sort of armour is available to the Indian Army in the Far East?
So the key thing to remember is that armoured mechanisation in the interwar period, actually, essentially, it fails. Okay, now there's lots and lots of stuff about the interwar period. You know, Rob Lyman and Richard Dannett have recently had their book that talked about mechanisation, focusing mostly on the British Army, but it includes stuff about the Indian Army. So there's lots and lots of stuff on that initial failing in the interwar period. But everyone sort of forgets that part about what happens to the Indian Army at the same time. People too much sort of interconnect the two different armies and why they the problems with mechanisation in those two periods. Now, the important thing to remember with the Indian Army is that other corps do mechanise. The artillery, the engineers and so forth, they mechanise sort of as planned. But armour, the tanks, is put off and put off and put off. Now, there are lots of reasons for this. There's a mixture of the poor economy, the fact that the Indian Army and the British Army have different roles. You know, the Indian Army is often, the simple way to put it is just they're sort of the imperial policeman side of things. They're also fighting on the northwest frontier, which is sort of what's now Pakistan and the border with Afghanistan. But also there are problems with things like the tech that's available at the time. Now, a lot of this is sort of erroneously has been put down over the decades to the attitude of the cavalry towards the idea of mechanization. That's certainly the stereotype that has been in most of the historiography of the time. You know, now, the thing is, they want the cavalry units. I mean, it's a more complex issue, frankly. The cavalry units want to keep their sort of their corporate regimental identities, but also plenty of them like the idea of belonging to something new. You know, so officers, NCOs, things like that, they stay together when units mechanized, even if then some of the, the new recruits and so forth are then redeployed to other arms. Now, generally, mechanized units need fewer men than, say, an infantry unit. So when the war breaks out, the Malayan campaign, you know, and falling back on Singapore and so forth, there are 20 Vickers Mark VI light tanks that were all captured by the Japanese at the end. You know, they're two Vickers machine guns. They're not really worth much. By the time the Japanese invade Burma in December 1941, most of the Indian armour has gone to the Middle East. Not that there is much of it, but most of it's gone to the Middle East. And a lot of it is also then equipped once it gets out there as well. So the only tanks in Burma at the beginning of the war sort of the beginning of the hostilities are the 7th Armour Brigade, who are diverted on their way to Malaya in February 1942. So actually, you know, 2.5 months, 3 months into the Japanese invasion. And they arrived just after the Sitang Bridge is destroyed by the retreating British military. That's the bit where the 17th Division, you know, cut off, you know, two of their brigades worth of men on the far side, and a load of them have to swim for it. A lot of them are lost. The 7th Armoured Brigade are bringing with them Stuart tanks, which are at least they're modern for the time, 1942.
So obviously the Japanese invade in 1942 and shit basically totally hits the fan at this point. How do the tank units assist in the withdrawal?
Yeah, so like I said, the 7th Armoured Brigade, they arrive just after the Sitang Bridge disaster. And essentially they're firefighting from the moment they arrive. You know, literally within a day or so of landing, they're actually taking part in their first actions. Now, what happens is they are completely spread all over the place because of the nature of this firefighting. Normally by squadron, but even down to sort of a half squadron, a few troops, you know, going to different places. Generally speaking, what they're doing is they're escorting infantry units that are exhausted already from the first couple of months of fighting and escorting them to the next sort of safe harbour. You know, sometimes they're going back and forth between places, they're carrying people on the backs of their tanks, they're carrying wounded and so forth. And at one point they are escorting the 1st Burma Division HQ, the Burma Army Area HQ at the time under General Alexander. And they actually have to then break out at a place called Taukian. They have to break through a quite hefty Japanese roadblock. There's an interesting scene here. General Alexander is often at this point giving orders personally to, you know, the tank units, the infantry units and so forth. They fail to break through on the first couple of occasions. And there's, you know, 7th Armoured Brigade have come from North Africa. They fought at places like Sidi Rezegh, Sidi Barani and so forth in North Africa in the early couple of years. Before being sent to the Far East. So they are experienced, but they also have some bad habits. You know, they're one of the units that does take casualties in North Africa when they charge lines of anti-tank guns in a sort of a cavalry fashion. And they bring some of this into Burma, and they're literally charging some of these roadblocks and like pushing through, you know, knocked out vehicles, logs, things like that that are across the roads. But at this particular place, Taukian, when they're trying to break through these roadblocks, one of the problems that they're having is that they're mining those roadblocks on the approaches. They are putting in things like there is a catch. I'm trying to remember the guy, poor guy's name. There is a captured soldier who is like not handcuffed. He's tied to a roadblock to stop the British just charging into it. And it's annoying, actually. I've just thought of it. I should have got the name ready. But he is actually freed. He actually manages to free himself and he rejoins his British unit eventually. But they're trying to charge through these roadblocks. And there's actually a bit of a missed opportunity here that this particular roadblock was actually a flank guard. And it was the Japanese, the 33rd Division was hooking round Rangoon to capture it. And so the roadblock the next day is lifted and they don't even realise they've got the whole of Burma Army's HQ there in a trap and they let them go. After the tanks have sort of softened it up and they then push through, but they then got away on the back of these tanks and in their vehicles as well. The most effective part, though, when they actually, and this is going to come to my bigger point sort of later on in this, the most sort of effective part of the fighting for 7th Armoured Brigade and also for, you know, 17th Division and the rest of the army at the time is when they get back to the sort of the central plain, so the Irrawaddy plain around places like Mektila, which will become important in 1945 again, but also when they retreat behind the Irrawaddy as well, and again on the Shwebo plain on the western side of the Irrawaddy River. So on these plains, either side of there, they're able to be a bit more organised, they're able to form what Slim calls his core striking force. And every time the Japanese make an incursion, first over the Pegu Yomas Mountains and then later over the Irrawaddy River, it's the 7th Armoured Brigade sort of squadron level that is sent to go and try and sort of nip that advance in the bud. The problem with this is they just cannot be everywhere. And so what generally happens is an effective counterattack by 7th Armoured Brigade causes lots and lots of Japanese casualties. But then somewhere else, the Japanese have broken through. They've got through an exhausted infantry brigade somewhere else, 20 miles north or 20 miles south, wherever. And at this point, the Japanese are beginning to get more and more reinforcements. The units from that fought in Malaya and Singapore are now arriving. They're bringing with them British vehicles that they've captured there and are able to then use those to then outflank the British units on these plains even faster than they were previously when they were marching through jungle, causing the retreat to get even worse. The retreat becomes more frantic as they're having to pull back faster as the Japanese are getting more troops behind them. Now, again, the 7th Armored Brigade is used to counterattack and to blow these, or to try and attack these unarmored columns of British ex-British lorries. And they do this very, very successfully. But again, they can't be everywhere. And so eventually they keep sort of like hitting the odd incursion here, the odd incursion there, but still having to pull back, still escorting units as well. So they're being pulled in these different directions. And eventually they get to the Chindwin, and it's the final sort of obstacle before India. Now, exhausted, the vehicles themselves are desperate for proper maintenance, even though at times they are able to take, you know, 24 hours to do some basic stuff. You know, the engines and gearbox are well over their normal service amount of time, you know, and they're run ragged. And they get to the Chindwin, and they end up having to abandon their Stuart tanks and burn them, you know, firing flares into them, firing flares inside them and other things like that. And some of the witnesses that, you know, I've been looking at writing the book have talked about, actually, there was a bit of emotion behind it. They'd never felt quite so attached to these tanks as, you know, previous ones in previous battles and so forth. I think because this was such a frantic sort of time. There is one tank that gets out, though, quite famously. They sent it on a recce to see if there was a land that they could get the tanks across and get them to Imphal. And it does successfully do it, but basically it would take too long. They couldn't organise it properly. And so that's why the decision is made to abandon the rest of the tanks. But this one tank then gets repurposed by the 7th Light Cavalry as an HQ tank. And it's called Curse of Scotland. And it then takes part in the invasion or the reconquest of Burma in 1945. Sort of brings the 7th Armoured Brigade circle full as well.
We're talking quite generally about tanks in Burma. Let's kind of go back to the beginning and start with my idiot question, which is, you say Burma to me, I've travelled extensively in Thailand, just next door, I think jungle. How does a tank go through the jungle? And I'm guessing this means that the Royal Engineers play a big part in this.
Yeah, so there's two big roles that the sappers actually do. So the first one is the logistical system, you know, and then there's the sort of what we in modern day you'd call combat engineering. So the first one, in terms of logistics, thousands of miles of, like, a network of thousands of miles of road are built, you know, and railways as well, in northeastern India, as well as also then airfields as well. So all these things need to be built. The roads in particular are probably the most famous thing that the Royal Engineers are building, aside from the airfields. There are also some really interesting sort of little extra things that are quite unique to this particular war, that are part of the war. So, for example, there's the use of the tea planters' labourers. You know, they are basically co-opted into the Royal Engineers, and they're used because it's such a labour-intensive way of building them. You know, they're building these switchback roads, you know, hairpin bends, you know, to climb the 5,000 feet up to the Kohima area, for example. You know, and then back down the other side into the plains on the, or sorry, down the other side into the you know, into the rest of Burma when you cross over the Chin Hills. You know, so you need huge amounts of labour, but you also get, you know, one of my favourite stories, and I'd recommend anyone who's listening to, if they can find a copy, get Elephant Bill, by James Williams. So the Elephant Bill in the title, it's his memoir. And he was a local teak farmer who'd fought in the First World War. He was in the Camel Corps as well, during the First World War, in the Middle East. He was using elephants for his teak farming, and he brought over 100 of them from the sort of the teak forests of Burma all the way to Imphal, including climbing the sort of the thousands of feet mountains to get them there, carrying refugees, women and children, of the families of his workers from his teak farm, and then others they pick up on the way to get them back. But he then gives them, or sorry, well, he runs them for the Royal Engineers, building bridges all the way through the mountains, building roads, what are called corduroy roads. So they're using logs laid down like corduroy to then, you know, be part of that logistical system. They're essentially part of the Royal Engineers as well. Now, just going back to airfields, that's a really big thing that they're doing. And probably of all of the sort of logistics of the war in Burma that people remember is aerial supply, dropping of supplies by parachute or planes landing in Ford airfields to then offload. You know, people always think of the Chindits, probably the biggest example to this, but it is used across the theatre. You know, the Battle of the Abin Box is famous for it. You know, Imphal and Kahima both rely on aerial supply, and also going into 1945. And it's used everywhere. And the thing that is forgotten is that all of those supply airfields are actually still, they still need road networks to get to them. And especially as you move forward into late 1944 and into 1945, those airfields need to be built on the far side of the big geographical features that make resupply so difficult, hence the need for the roads. So even though everyone's like, oh, well, it's all just aerial supply in Burma, you have to remember is that someone's got to drive that thing to the airfield. And especially later in the war, they're driving over those mountains, over those awful roads that are, you know, practically destroyed every monsoon and need rebuilding. You know, they have to get to those airfields as well. And then the airfields can do their thing and drop their stuff forward, which is dramatic and amazing. And I get that, and I completely agree with it. But don't forget that someone still had to drive from Dimapur, maybe, in northeastern India, you know, hundreds of miles up thousands of feet of road and back down the other side to get to a Ford airfield on the far side of the Chin Hills, say, in 1945. Now, they're still having to do that. But then looking at the combat engineers, they're building bridges in the Ford areas, sometimes under fire. They're using Valentine scissor bridge laying tanks, you know, the ones with the big scissor opening bridge on top. And even just using bulldozers to push earth into dried up riverbeds and stream beds and things like that. You know, by 1944, bulldozers basically up in the Ford units all of the time because of this. One of the more famous things they do is they create ramps and platforms for fire support. For example, in the Battle of Kahima, it should be said, maybe we'll talk about this later, but the siege of Kahima, there's not really any tanks involved for fairly obvious reasons. It's infantry units cut off from the outside. It's the counterattack and then the sort of the retaking of the Kahima ridges that is when the tanks are used like this. But the Royal Engineers are building the ramps up those hills and the platforms for fire support so they can get the guns to the right angles. I think just you mentioned about jungle warfare as well, is one of the big things to remember about that is that the jungle warfare is really a means to an end. Now, this is probably going to be the most controversial thing that I say during this recording. Once any hope of amphibious assaults is ruled out, you know, because of shipping shortages and so forth, the slogging through the jungle exists to get 14th Army onto the central dry plains of where the Allied advantages in firepower, you know, logistics and so forth can be most effective. And without being too crude about it, it's also these are the places where the killing that needs to happen to win a war, you know, to defeat the Japanese armies takes place. Mm. They have to be on the plains and the surrounding hills of those plains to take place. You know, in the jungles, the units are very, very small unit actions, platoons, sections, companies. You're not going to attrit an enemy completely by that. And Burma does have planes where you can get your tanks out onto them. And when I say plane, I'm of course talking about, you know, big, wide open, flat areas, Salisbury Plain, you know, things like that. And like to sort of put this in perspective, so like I said earlier, in 1942, the most effective fighting that takes place for the British and Indian armies takes place when they're on the central plain mid-March to mid-April. Okay. In 1943, probably the biggest disaster bar the retreat is when tanks aren't really involved. There's not really a plane that's involved. And it's also before the major changes that Slim makes when he takes over and Eastern Army becomes 14th Army. Now, none of those big changes have taken place yet. But then you get to 1944. What does Slim do when the Japanese invasion of India begins? He withdraws his units out of the jungle onto the Imphal Plain, where he wants to fight his battle. He doesn't want to fight on the Tidim Road in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of the Chin Hills. He wants to come back out of the jungle, destroy the Japanese army on the Imphal Plain. Now, remember, yeah. It's worth remembering Kahima is a surprise. He does not expect Kahima to happen in the way that it does anyway. But that's a different story, really. his plan is to fight on the Imphal plain, and that's what he does. Okay, and it should be said, the jungle that surrounds the Imphal plain on the hills around it is not the thick jungle that you find elsewhere. It's more like sort of scrubland. Now, if you look at the pictures of the time, it is not the thick jungle that you expect necessarily of Burma, because it's northeastern India. You know, and it's not quite the same place. Even though geographically they're very close to each other, there is a difference around that area. And then obviously 1945, the most famous example of this would be Operation Capital, is the plan for the reconquest. The plan there is to fight and destroy the Japanese on the Shwebo Plain between the Chindwin and the Irrawaddy. When the Japanese retreat behind the Irrawaddy River, they just transplant the same idea and they do it again on the Irrawaddy Plain. You know, the difference now is they've got to cross a much bigger river than they had originally envisaged. But at the end of the day, all of these examples, with the exception of Arakan, which doesn't go well, they are fighting most effectively when they're on the plains.
We've been talking about getting these tanks through and building bridges and everything else, but there's a question here that's missing, and that is to do with, what if a tank breaks? What about keeping it maintained? And how in the hell are they getting all of these spares to the front?
Yeah, of course. So, that's obviously a massive deal, because at the end of the day, every single tank that goes to the front line is driven there. Now, most of them are driven on transporters, although there are lots of examples where, because of the steep hills and so forth, they're offloading tanks to then drag the transporter up, because the transporter isn't powerful enough to take the tank on the back. You know, I think it was the Royal Deccan Horse in 1945. They end up doing something like 200 miles on their own tracks, which they didn't originally plan to do. And they end up having to do maintenance before they even cross the Irrawaddy River, when they should have got there on the back of transporters and not needed any maintenance. But no, the main point is that the normal spares are delivered either by parachute or, you know, air supply drop, or they're coming forward when they're closer to base. Like, say, for example, in Imphal, they're coming like by normal lorries and things like that. There were experiments done on flying disassembled Sherman tanks, although it was ruled out as being impractical. They'd have to keep too many men on airfields close to the front line. They'd need feeding as part of the supply system. They'd need defending if the area was attacked, although they'd be expected to take part in that. And you know, those men's only job would be to reassemble tanks, and that was seen as too impractical. It was easier just to fly them forward. In terms of the day-to-day maintenance, this is actually really effective, and this was one of the most original parts of my research when I was studying this. Is the big thing they did was they took the normal system of echeloned sort of like maintenance. So a lot of listeners will know what I'm talking about here, but you have the sort of the fighting echelon, you have the B echelon, the C echelon, and so forth, and they're just different stages behind the front line. And the further back you go, the more heavy the repair is to take place. So it might be at C echelon that you're literally taking the tank apart, repairing it, putting it back together. B echelon might be repairing some basic stuff. You know, and up at the front line, it's literally you're patching things together, replacing a track, a slightly damaged track or something, nothing major. What they do in 14th Army in the tank brigades there is they take each one of those steps and they move it slightly further closer to the front line. So the C echelon stuff is moved forward to B echelon. The B echelon stuff is moved forward to a new thing they call the Advanced Workshop Detachment. And so all of the heavy repair just happens slightly closer than originally planned. And what this means is that you don't need to take tanks away from the frontline units for as long, and therefore you keep them in action longer. So for example, if you've got a tank that needs something really severe, a whole engine change, which would normally go back, you lose it for a week. You now only lose it for 24 hours, maybe. So they're able to keep the firepower available in good numbers to the infantry whilst they're fighting, because the maintenance is happening so much closer to, rather than having to pull them all the way back.
Okay, so we've looked at how. Let's look at what they do with them. I don't know if you saw me waffling on Woody's channel about Tarawa recently. Japanese are quite good at defence. What's bunker busting?
Yeah, so this is the key thing. I think it's Tim Moorman, the very good historian on this. He literally describes the most difficult tactical problem that the 14th Army, and it probably applies, to be honest, to anyone that faced the Japanese, who was having to attack the Japanese. The biggest tactical problem that you ever come up against is the Japanese bunker. So let's just think about it again. From 1942, the Japanese go on the defensive, generally speaking, excepting the 1944 invasion of India, which is essentially a roll of the dice to try and come to a decisive conclusion quickly. Now, key locations, when they go on to this defensive, they build bunker complexes. 5 to 10 men in a bunker, you know, a few light machine guns, and the drive to sell their lives dearly. They build these bunkers overlooking each other, interlocking fields of fire. You know, one bunker can shoot on the roof of another bunker, the other bunker can shoot on both of those two bunkers, things like that. They have log walls with earth piled up against the sides, you know, up to 5 feet on top of them as well. All but a direct hit from medium artillery can get through that roof. You know, a big enough aerial bomb, again, could get through. The problem with all of that, though, is that artillery and aerial bombing is just not accurate enough. Okay, certainly not accurate enough to allow the infantry to be close enough to take advantage of, if you're not destroying them, but then the suppression. Okay, so if the artillery could land its artillery on a five pence piece on the top of that bunker accurately every single time, then fine, this would work. The Japanese could sneak up close. The infantry could sneak up close to the Japanese bunker and then assault it. But they can't. It's too risky. Also, high explosive shells, when they land from the artillery with relatively plunging fire, same for mortars, the high explosive explodes outwards, you know, in 360 degrees. The big sort of improvement, and the reason why, or one of the big reasons why I argue about why tanks are so important, even in jungle settings in the war against Burma, is the one weapon that you can bring forwards that can solve the unacceptable infantry casualties when attacking these bunkers is by bringing forward the tank. Now, there is an attempt at this. The first Arakan, Noel Irwin, the general in charge, he panics at the failure to capture Donbak, where there's a bunker complex in February 1943. It's a general disaster anyway, but when he panics, he brings up 8 Valentine infantry tanks. He's so panicked, he doesn't give them time to have a reconnaissance. The tanks then go in, loads of them get bogged down on ground that's not really suitable for tanks, and others are then destroyed by artillery. You know, it's actually a bit of a bloodbath. Very few of the crews actually survive. They get killed when they evacuate the tanks, a lot of them. They're not destroyed in general. Over the next year, though, they then, through the monsoon period, you know, one of the things is, lots of accounts of the war talk about, you know, fighting through drenching monsoon, raining jungle, when actually most of the time the monsoon's a quiet time. There isn't as much fighting. And at this time, infantry units are pulled out of the line. And what they do is the newly formed 25th Dragoons, who are going to be a big part of the war in Burma, they train with infantry units and then secretly move to the Arakan at the end of 1943. In January, during the attack in the Arakan, they come across a place called Razabil. And famously, there's a large bunker complex in particular on a feature there called Tortoise. Now, it's here that they first get to try their bunker busting method properly. The method that they come up with, and you know, if you allow to indulge me here, a quick description of it. So artillery and aerial bombardment will be used to then clear the vegetation. That makes it easier to see the bunkers that have already been identified. And they also will do some suppression. The tanks and infantry can then close in. The infantry obviously are keeping to cover at this point. The tanks can't keep to cover. And they then close up to the bunkers, relatively close, maybe 50 metres, 30 metres, you know, depends how obvious they are. And what they're doing is they're firing high explosive shells at the bunkers. They might send a few armour-piercing ones first to loosen some of the earth, but the main thing is they then fire high explosive as best they can into the firing slits. The infantry continue to work forward. And this is important, by the way. I mentioned the 360-degree explosion of a high explosive artillery round. With the 75mm tank cannon, the shrapnel from the explosion goes with the momentum of the initial round. So it fires almost like after the explosion. It doesn't come back on you like with a 360-degree explosion. It hits its target and the shrapnel continues going from the explosion from the explosive. What that does is that gives the infantry that little bit extra confidence to get that little bit closer. On a signal, and that could be a flag, it could be a very light, you know, firing the flare guns. Whatever it is, a prearranged signal, the infantry will get to the position they want to be in, signal to the tanks, change fire, and then the tanks go to armour-piercing and machine gun fire. The reason for this is the armor piercing looks and sounds the same when it leaves the tank as the high explosive. If there are any surviving Japanese inside, they keep their heads down. But then it doesn't explode. There is no risk to the infantry. And at this final moment, the infantry then get up and charge it, at which point the tank stops firing. You know, they could be 10 yards away when they stand up. Tank stops firing. And then that they go in with the grenade, the kukri if they're Gurkhas, you know, the bayonet and so forth. And they clear it. And whilst the Razabil, the tortoise operation, is not an entire success, you know, that it is one. This is one particular action where they happen to use this particular method. And everyone goes, that's a really good method. We should try that again. But the overall operation is not quite as successful. It does send a message to the rest of the army, to the higher ups and so forth. And this stuff is then disseminated. The 25th Dragoons, like a few weeks later, repeat and perfect this at the Battle of the Admin Box the following month. Now, obviously, famously, they're providing a lot of defensive firepower, but often during the day in particular, they're sallying out of the admin box with the infantry and clearing Japanese bunker positions on the hills when they capture them. Now, whenever a key feature surrounding them is captured, it's the 25th Dragoons and infantry that go in and then clear it.
Right, let's get into some more specifics. We've been doing lots of specifics, but we're going to get into some more specifics because our listeners, when they're listening about tank things, they love to learn more detail.
They're sitting there now going, shut up, being general, and give me a battle.
Well, exactly. That's what we're going to talk about. And I'm so going to pronounce them incorrectly, but I do not care. We're talking about Imphal and Kohima. Talk us through what the tanks did during those battles.
So when we look at the Battle of Imphal and Kohima, you know, one of the things that's going to make Chris happy, obviously, is that this brings the sappers back in. So really important to say, Kohima is a battle where tanks are only really used after the siege has ended. So I'm not going to be trying to convince you that tanks are the reason that the siege of Kohima was successful. They are not involved whatsoever. Now, all of this is about when the 2nd Division, you know, when they arrive on the area, having come south from the Dimapur supply base, the counterattack to recapture the area surrounding the siege, and obviously, you know, breaking through to the siege and rescuing the besieged, essentially. So this is the 2nd Division. It's the 149th Royal Armoured Corps, 150th Royal Armoured Corps and others. And the Royal Engineers who then build all of the ramps up the various different hills. Okay, the really famous one is the Tennis Court. You know, everyone has heard of the Battle of the Tennis Court and part of the Kohima battle, fighting over it for days and days and days during the siege. And then also to clear it. It's part of the sort of highest point of the area and they have to clear it. So what they do, the 2nd Dorsets are the ones that, again, 2nd Division unit, they have relieved the Royal West Kents and the other units that were besieged and are now clearing the area alongside the other units.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, what happens is that there are various infantry attempts to clear the tennis court, but they fail. The Japanese have really dug in a huge number of bunkers to keep hold of it, to consolidate it over this period. And what happens is, there is an attempt to get a tank up there before the Royal Engineers come under fire. But when they try to get one of the 150th RAC's tanks up there, it actually slips down the side. It should be said that at this point, it's just before the monsoon as well. This is sort of end of April, beginning of May. One of the tanks has slipped down the sort of the hillside. And so it's seen as maybe this isn't a good idea. We're not going to be able to get tanks up there. But when they do manage to clear one of the neighbouring hills, the hospital spur, you know, where the old hospital was, they build a ramp up to that one. And this time they're going to attack from above the tennis court. Now, what this takes is, so the Dorsets then sort of, they have a bit of a conflab, sort of the 11th and 12th of May. They have a couple of different discussions. Second Dorsets, 150th Royal Army Corps. And what they do is, there's a particular guy, Sergeant Waterhouse, who is the tank commander of one of the Lee Grants. So Lee Grant's the perfect tank, by the way, for the fighting in Burma. You know, they've got the 75mm gun that does most of the bunker busting, but then you've got the 37mm sort of cannon in the turret as well, which is really good for, you know, keeping Japanese infantry off of you, and you can engage two different targets at the same time, as well as machine guns. So it's like the perfect tank for all of this. What they do is, he's looked at some plans. He goes forward one night with the Dorsets, and he recces on foot where he's going to be going. He's looking down the tennis court, and he works out, you know, there's about this 8 to 10 foot drop, you know, accounts differ. He reckons he can drop his tank down it. He reckons he can safely get down this particular drop. So the Royal Engineers then build this ramp through up Hospital Spur. They can then get to the sort of the area around the tennis court and the Deputy Commissioner's bungalow. And on the 13th of May, they then drive up there. The second Dorsets, they've planned an infantry assault that's going to coincide with this. And he brings his tank to the edge of the sort of the step. I don't, like, for those that know, the tennis court is on one bit and it's like a terraced hill with different levels. He gets to the edge of this terrace where this drop is, and he just teeters his tank over and tries to sort of judge the point when he's going to tip as slowly as he can. Now, this is a sort of 26, 27 ton tank, you know, that's going to drop 8 to 10 feet down. And he balances it just right before it's going to drop, so that when he goes, he'll stay upright, basically. You know, and I almost struggle to sort of picture it and quite comprehend exactly how he manages it. But he does manage it. And he, not only that, they drop onto a Japanese bunker that they built at the foot of this place that they hadn't actually identified, basically crushing the Japanese soldiers inside. But at this point, and this is what I'm so often talking about with the importance of armor, he can then methodically just point and shoot at each of the identified bunkers. The second Dorsets are coming with him. They are then doing the classic bunker busting stuff, firing the different types of ammunition, the HE, the armor piercing, and clearing the bunkers just one by one. The Japanese don't have any anti-tank weapons of real note. You know, there are suicide tactics. There are attempts to throw grenades in hatches or pole charges and so forth. But the infantry are pretty perfectly capable of holding that off. You know, they're close by. They've got submachine guns and rifles. There's plenty of them. And most of the Japanese are staying within their bunkers anyway and are basically just being offered up for, frankly, slaughter. You know, and this is repeated on all of the different hillsides around the Kohima site, you know, over the course of these weeks. But that's just Kohima. Okay, the actual bigger tank battle is at Imphal. Now, this is by far the biggest use of tanks in the whole of 1944. Now, they're used in a similar way to the Battle of the Admin Box. You know, Imphal, for those that don't know, the easiest metaphor to describe it is Imphal is like the centre of a wheel, and then there are different roads that go off like spokes of a wheel in different directions. You know, one goes off to Kohima, another one goes to where the next Chindwin River crossing is, one goes south, there's the Tidim Road, there's one that goes back across the mountains towards a place called Ukrul, through the mountains to the west. You know, spokes of a wheel, essentially. And Imphal Plain is turned into a series of defensive box in the various villages that dot around it. They call Imphal itself the keep, you know, like a castle's keep. And they post infantry units in the hills around it. There's, interestingly, a sort of a bit of a race to occupy the hills around the outside when they discover the Japanese are there, as well as to sort of occupy the major villages, you know, river crossings of the couple of local rivers and things like that. And what they essentially are doing is then the tanks are used, like at the admin box, to go to the different crisis points to clear the Japanese from whatever feature they've gone to. So by far the most famous example of this would be B Squadron of the 3rd Carabiniers, who go to Nunshigum. Now, Nunshigum is a large feature. It's kind of a bit like an upside down Y. There are sort of two ridge lines that come out at the bottom and then a narrower ridge line that points north. And the Japanese, over the course of sort of beginning of April, by the 9th of April, they fought their way onto it. They've knocked off an Indian unit, the 9th Jats. They've knocked them off. And after a couple of days of back and forth fighting, the hill actually changes hands a couple of different times. They have the British and Indian commanders, they have a meeting on the 12th of April and they decide we have to clear it. And one of the people that's at this meeting is the commander of the 3rd Carabiniers, Ralph Younger, who fought with the 7th Hussars, part of the 7th Army Brigade, in the retreat in 1942. He's now been promoted. He's now in charge of 3rd Carabiniers. He says, I can get tanks up there. And what they do is and this is 3,800 feet higher. This is this is the tallest hill on the Imphal Plain. It's only 8 miles from Imphal itself. You know, it's basically the closest that the Japanese get to Imphal. It overlooks one of the airfields that's even closer than Imphal. Between Imphal and the hill is one of the airfields that's resupplying everyone. You know, it has to be held. It has to be recaptured. The Japanese have captured it. So they get the 3rd Carabiniers to the base of it. They're going up there with the 2nd Battalion of the Dogras, another Indian battalion. And they split B Squadron into two different halves, a couple of troops on each side. And they make their way up the two ridge lines at the south. Notice it's like an upside down Y. They go up the two sort of short bits of the Y, and then they meet at the base of what's called the first bump. There are two bumps, one slightly southern, one slightly northern. And the one they meet at is like where the two lines of the upside down Y meet. So they meet at this first one, and they were expecting Japanese resistance at this point. But it hasn't materialised. They're actually quite surprised. So far, there's not really been much going on. The one thing that has been happening is there have been some Voltiventures dive bombers and hurry bombers have been dive bombing the positions, the known Japanese positions on the hill. Also, they've put artillery down either side of the hill because the valleys either side are still in British and Indian hands. They're firing the artillery onto the hillside from either side. There are some diversionary attacks by the lighter tank, the Stuart tanks of the 7th Light Cavalry as well, down in one of the valleys as well, just to try and distract any Japanese reinforcements, stop them from coming in. And what they do is they get to the top of the first bump and cross over it, and there's quite a steep dip before you then get to the second bump, which is sort of at the northern end of the ridge. And it's at this point that, to use the old soldiers cliche, all hell breaks loose. The Japanese now decide it's the time to really strike them. And part of the reason for this is the British tanks, the 3rd Carabiniers, they've had to go into a single line. They're now one tank front. They are unable to have more than one tank basically firing on a target at this point. They just, like, the ridge is too narrow. It's basically a razorback ridge. What this means is that the tank commanders have to have their lids open, their tank hatches open, but they're actually almost sat up on the edge of the tank, like the ring of the tank hatch, so that they can tell the driver by the intercom to sort of shift left, shift right, so they don't go plummeting down the hillside, you know, 3,800 feet. You know, it's literally a razorback, you know, and if you go on Google Earth, you can, you know, if people want to go on Google Earth and find this, it's to the top right of Imphal. You can see just how much of a knife edge this ridge is. And the Japanese are attacking them from multiple sides. The tank commanders are trying to navigate, but they're also using Tommy guns and grenades to fight off Japanese infantry. The Dogras are taking casualties as well, and they're beginning to hang back. Within about half an hour, and this is sort of about midday now, quarter past 12, all of the tank commanders, bar none of B Squadron, are killed. Killed or wounded. A lot of them have had like single bullet wounds to the head and they've dropped down inside the tank. Some of the tanks are ordered back. The ones who've lost officers and so forth are pulled back. There are still a few tanks left with, you know, NCOs in charge of them. And it's at this point that the Sergeant Major, James Craddock, he and the Subedar of the first, was essentially like a sergeant major. They're both a similar rank. The Subedar of the Dogras, they both sit there and they come up with their little plan. And they decide that Craddock is going to send his troops to the left flank of the Japanese sort of position on the northern bump, the second bump, whilst another tank then can come at it straight on, which they then successfully do. The Dogras then assault it in the same bunker busting we've described, and finally clear it. Okay, and then they're able to pull the tanks off of the ridges that night. You know, well, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Japanese are essentially cleared. You know, there's nearly 300 Japanese bodies are recovered. You know, it's really only the tank commanders and, you know, a few dozen Dogra troops that have been killed. A lot more have been wounded. But relatively speaking, the casualties are lighter than expected. As tragic as every one of those deaths is, they managed to clear it at 3,800 feet high, with tanks fighting at the top of it and are basically the main part of it. That the Japanese had no anti-tank weapons because they did not expect at any point that you were going to get a tank up there. And this is something that, again, is repeated elsewhere. When you get the other parts, you know, the tanks are pulled back there, but you then get more conventional fighting. You know, tanks are going to places like Bishanpur, to Potsang Bam, you know, which, of course, the soldiers nicknamed Pots and Pans. You know, they're going to these different boxes, you know, and they're, like I said, they're going out like a sort of striking force. And they're smashing Japanese incursions wherever they appear. And it's the same sort of pattern that's repeated. You find a Japanese incursion. Naturally, they've dug in the 5-6 hours, maybe 24 hours since it's been identified. By the time the tanks arrive, they've got reasonably good bunkers. And then they're having to clear them, you know, and clearing villages and so forth.
OK, let's talk about a siege. What can a tank do at the siege of Mektila?
Yeah, so the big thing to talk about firstly with sort of the siege of Mektila is the main plan that took place at that point. Okay, so essentially what's happened is after the Imphal battle had severely weakened Japanese divisions, they're chased back through the monsoons, which is highly unusual at the time. You know, everyone normally rests during the monsoon. This is the time when Slim realizes his opportunity. The Japanese are completely severely weakened after Imphal and Kohima. So he chases them to the Chindwin through the monsoon. So this is the closest to that stereotype of, you know, dripping jungle and so forth that we're talking about. And they push them to the Chindwin. And the plan then, Operation Capital, is to cross over, destroy the bulk of the Japanese army, what's left of it, and then push on in Operation Extended Capital, then capture Rangoon before the next monsoon in 1945. So Operation Capital, the idea is to, you know, get across the Chindwin and destroy the Japanese on the Shuebo Plain and then push on to Rangoon. Okay, but the Japanese retreat behind the Irrawaddy River. And so the British and Indian Army, they then have to cross a major river obstacle to then continue the initial plan, destroy the Japanese on one of the central plains of Burma. To do this, the plan is, you'll send 33 Corps with 254th Tank Brigade. They're going to cross the river further north. They're going to attack Mandalay. That will hopefully bring Japanese reinforcements up to them. This is in January 1945. At the same time, in great secrecy, 4 Corps with 255th Tank Brigade, they're going to move 200 miles south in great secrecy, and then they're going to cross the river and drive for Mektila. Okay, and that's the key supply hub in Burma. You know, that's why Mektila is such an important place. You know, Japanese supplies arrive there. That's where they then arrive at Mektila, and then they go out in the various different directions to the various different Japanese commands in Burma by road and railway. They have both there. So the town is really, really important to the Japanese military. It's also really conveniently placed where, if the Japanese have sent reinforcements north to Mandalay, it kind of ends up bottling up the Japanese army between 33rd Corps at Mandalay and 4 Corps at Mektila. That also then means the Japanese have to respond, so they have to take troops away from the fighting for Mandalay, send it south to Mektila, dividing the Japanese military between the two of them. Slim described it as 33 Corps was the hammer to 4 Corps' anvil at Mektila. So that's kind of like the importance of it. And the way it's achieved is what's that a modern military person called a thunder on. Think back Baghdad in 2003, what Putin wanted to do to Kiev in February 2022. You send a big armoured spearhead, in this case 255th Tank Brigade, with mechanised infantry. So two brigades of the 17th Indian Division, they've been mechanised over the sort of the autumn and winter of 1944. And then you capture Mektila and its airfields. You know, you leave no sort of road behind you. They're having all of their resupply by planes. They capture Mektila and its airfields. Another infantry division is flown in by plane. But now they are surrounded, hence the name Siege of Mectila, which is actually the biggest part of it. They take Mectila relatively easily, but they know that they've kicked a hornet's nest at this point. I mean, that's part of the plan, to be honest. Slim wants to fight his battle in this area because it's the central plain that, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times. They want to fight the Japanese, you know, in this area because that's where air power, artillery, tanks, maneuver warfare, you know, and that's what a lot of this is. All of those things, all of their advantages in this are in this area. You know, the British and Indian military have a much bigger advantage over the Japanese at this point. They can use their bunker busting techniques when needed. You know, you can use it in towns. You can easily adapt it to street fighting, to be honest. And so they're able to do this in the surrounding towns and villages as well. And obviously, they've not left any sort of logistical tail. They're not having to protect themselves. This is a key difference to European armoured tactics. You know, I've joked before that, you know, what would have happened if 30 Corps at Market Garden had been allowed to just go off, you know, and rely entirely on air supply. You know, that's a little bit of a joke. You know, that probably wouldn't actually work, but still we can dream if Slim was there. You know, if Slim was in Europe, that will set Twitter warriors off. Now, the overall command of the defence of the Siege of Mectila was down to Major General Punch Cowan, 17th Indian Division, who I've mentioned were mechanised. Basically, and that's an important point, they mechanised an entire division specifically because they need to keep up with the tanks. You know, this reflects the importance that they have.
Yeah.
Now, his plan is to make all arms columns, put them into six harbours around the town. Okay, so it's not like a linear defence. Okay, there are six harbours around the town. You know, they're tanks, infantry, engineers, self-propelled artillery. They're mostly the American priests because most of the vehicles are coming directly from America. So they're not getting the sextons, for example, that are going to European British units. They're getting the priests mostly. And what they're doing is every time the Japanese approach, they send out whatever the nearest, you know, all arms column, and they're just going out and swatting it away. Now, the thing is, the Japanese are doing something that they do all the time throughout the war. Is they send in reinforcements piecemeal. They don't wait to sort of build up a much more decisive, you know, they're not very Clausewitzian, I suppose, in that regard. They're not applying all of their strength in one concentrated weak area. They're just sending them in. And this completely plays into the hands of Cowan and his plan for defence. You know, so they're sending out these armoured columns and they're finding, you know, there are Japanese troops who are being brought forward in their lorries, have no idea that they're about to be ambushed. And then they cross over, you know, like a shallow hill. And then all of a sudden, they've got Sherman tanks surrounding them and just blasting them to pieces. In other places, the Japanese are sort of beginning to concentrate. But again, the next column has then come in and defeated them. And there is some bunker busting as well here because it's everywhere. Whenever the Japanese dig in somewhere, they build bunkers. It's not part of the Siege of Mectila, but because just afterwards, but when they start to drive south, a place called Pyulbwe, just south of Pyulbwe. And George MacDonald Fraser describes this kind of operation with these all-arms columns going out. He describes that in Quartered Safe Out Here. Again, if anyone's read that, you know, fantastic memoir. But he does include a description of, you know, bunker busting with Sherman tanks, you know, at this town, Pyulbwe, just outside Mectila. Now, the reason this is so successful is because this sort of all-arms column plan means that the Japanese never, ever actually get the initiative. They are supposedly the besieging force. You would expect them to be picking and choosing where and when they attack. But because the British and the Indian units are deliberately, you know, they're using aggressive patrolling to make sure they know what's coming. They're using aerial reconnaissance and so forth. You know, every time there's Japanese movement, they're able to coordinate their columns to who's the closest, who's the nearest that needs to be there, and then they're sending them out to face them. And what this does is that thing about initiative. The Japanese are supposed to be picking and choosing where they fight, and they're not. The British are always able to hit them when they're least expecting it, simply by this greater intelligence and the greater maneuverability of their columns, and also the greater firepower of that column. So if they meet a Japanese column on the move, you know, it's an encounter battle, they have the firepower to do something about that, whereas the Japanese don't really have that. They don't have an ability to do that. They have to dismount and then fight. And they don't have effective anti-tank methods throughout the war. You know, they're still using mostly using the same 47mm anti-tank gun that they were using in 1942. That was just about sufficient against a Stuart if you hit it in the flank or the side, or you hit it in the tracks. But it's no good against you know, Lee Grants in 1944. It's no good against the Shermans here at Mactila or the Lee Grants further north in Mandalay. You know, they're just not good enough. You know, either that or it's suicide tactics, you know, Japanese soldiers digging a hole in the ground with an aerial bomb in their hand and a rock. And, you know, there are eyewitness accounts. You read a number of different memoirs. When they come across a Japanese soldier, you know, if the infantry come across a Japanese soldier in a pit in the ground with a bomb between his legs and a rock, he doesn't detonate it because he's been told to wait for a tank. So he's shot in place. You know, in one of the books I've got here, I can't remember which one it is, there is a picture of a Japanese soldier who is being killed. And it's quite a gruesome picture. But he's literally just sat there basically straddling a bomb, waiting for someone, waiting for that tank to come along. He's been shot in place. He hasn't bothered to try and take the infantry that have discovered him with him, if you see what I mean. And it just shows you the desperation because they haven't developed proper anti-tank methods. You know, their tanks aren't really good enough anyway, not that they have enough of them. There's a small number of them in Mactila. There's a small tank-on-tank battle in Imphal. There's a small tank-on-tank battle in 1942. But generally speaking, they don't happen. The Japanese don't have that many, and they're just not that effective. Often when they are met, they're just used as mobile pillboxes. You know, there's one that's even just destroyed in situ, doesn't even try to fight back when it's attacked from behind in the siege of Mactila when it's harboured up. It fires back, but it doesn't try to manoeuvre, which again would be complete anathema to an Indian or British tank crew. You know, it's all about movement. That's the point of the tank.
You've already mentioned Rangoon previously, but how are tanks actually used for the push of Rangoon?
Okay, so this is the point actually where when you move south from Mactila towards Rangoon, you come back towards some jungle. You know, so the tanks have to stick to the road. The second part as well is, and the big problem for 14th Army is, the race to Rangoon is as much a race against time as it is anything else. You know, so the Japanese have taken huge, huge casualties at Mandalay, at Mactila. You know, Slim's plan, Operation Capital, goes perfectly. You know, they do cause immense casualties. And the Japanese army is now retreating in disarray. When they break off at Mactila, after they've been crushed between 4th and 33rd Corps, you know, 33rd Corps coming down south from Mandalay, you know, where the bulk of the casualties are, you know, the Japanese retreat in disarray toward Rangoon, although they are later then diverted east to cross back towards Thailand. They are chased back through the jungle by armoured spearheads. And at this point, you're getting almost like the Great Swan in 1944 after the Normandy campaign. They are driving and overtaking Japanese units, sometimes having to fight them off, but more often leaving them for the infantry to mop up. And eventually, as they're making this drive south, they reach, and they have a couple, there are a couple of sort of relatively large set-piece battles for the numbers involved, but most of them are pushed aside quite quickly. And there is this feeling, a bit like, you know, with the charging tactics that, you know, that I was saying that the 7th Armoured Brigade sometimes brought that from the Western Desert in the earlier part of the war. You see a little bit of that come back, almost a cavalry spirit. A couple of the memoirs in that talk about, you know, there is a feeling of a hunt, a chase to this, you know, like a fox hunt on horses. You know, you kind of can never take the cavalry thing away from them. Because they're pushing through these places, and even in the jungle now, the Japanese fail, apart from a couple of occasions, to really put up any real stiff resistance. And the enemy becomes the weather. So as they reach Paegu, which they have to fight through, well, they have to fight to capture, 50 miles north of Rangoon, this is the point where the monsoon starts, and it comes a week early. Okay, and they're this close to Rangoon, you know. And what happens is at the end of April, you know, just before this point, there is an amphibious assault and they capture Rangoon from the south. You know, finally the shipping has come across from Europe and they then capture Rangoon from the south, you know, up through, they come up into the Irrawaddy Delta and land there. What this means is that they decide to halt the advance because of the difficulty of the monsoon at Paegu. And people like George MacDonald Fraser, again, he mentioned this in Quarter Safe Out Here, the disappointment they felt at not actually being, you know, I think he uses the phrase something like that Rangoon was ours, you know, we'd earned it. You know, in 17th Division, who's, you know, again, they're not the only one that's taken part in this, but they are spearheading again at the end of April into the beginning of May. There is this sense of disappointment that they weren't the ones to do it. They were the ones that had retreated across the Sitang Bridge in 1942 and two-thirds of them had been you know, cut off. You know, they had this immense history in Burma. They fought the entire length of this campaign, you know, and really felt a sense of possession towards Rangoon that they've lost, you know, which is quite sad in a way. But at the end of the day, you know, Rangoon needed to be taken because it was the only way to resupply the troops in the rest of Burma once the monsoon started. You know, the roads coming, you know, hundreds of miles, nearly 1,000 miles from Dimapur in northeastern India, the main supply base for Burma. You know, a lot of the roads in northeastern India, in northwestern Burma, would become unusable, you know, and the planes wouldn't be able to resupply them. So the priority had to be capturing Rangoon. And so it was done. It's just that, you know, some of the guys in 4 Corps, in 33rd Corps, you know, were disappointed it wasn't them. That was all. Okay, but the tanks had been the armoured spearhead for that. They had pushed through, you know, in almost cavalier fashion, breaking through what little resistance there was, overtaking other ones. You know, there's even, this is the point where most of the prisoners, of however, you know, it's only a few hundred, I think, but this is the point where the majority of any prisoners taken in the war are taken at this point. Because again, there's a sense that a lot of them have given up.
Jack, this has been an absolute masterclass. There are a load of tank nerds out there who like dry humping Churchills, not this Churchill, who have thoroughly enjoyed the last hour. Thank you so much. And I'm taking it this is what your book is about in the summer.
Yeah, do you know what? We didn't even mention it yet. So the book is, I'm terrible at plugging, clearly.
Yeah.
But yeah, the book is called Forgotten Armour, Tank Warfare in Burma, although that's not the Forgotten Armour bit's definite. You know, it's Forgotten Armies, Forgotten Armour. So I was quite pleased with that. But yeah, Forgotten Armour, Tank Warfare in Burma is probably what it will be called, although that subtitle might change. But yeah, that'll be out in the summer of 2024. I'm hoping to have some advanced copies available when I speak at the We Have Ways Fest in the end of July. So hopefully.
Brilliant. Fingers crossed for that, and we will see you there.
Yeah, thank you guys. I've had an amazing time. Thank you for having me on.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books. You can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.